Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in middle America, where we can't get it to stop dumping snow on us. It's just been crazy this winter. I know you guys aren't always looking for a weather report when I come on, but, you know, it's funny. In 2018, I think we had 2 weeks of spring and 2 weeks of fall. And then this long winter that's been going on since October that doesn't usually really even start until after Christmas. We maybe get a snow shower or two and some chilly weather. But at this point where we sit today, last night, I think we got another, I don't know, 6 or 7 inches on top of the 6 or 7 we already had. And they're looking for, I guess, worse at this point. Thank God there's a couple days and it could change, but Saturday maybe 5 to 7 inches of snow. And our pattern has kind of been that it is like minus 20 wind chills and horrible single digit teen freezing temperatures that are brutally unbearable. And then when it warms up, and this is really weird to hear a Midwesterner say at 23, you know, that it's feeling like a heat wave. But whenever that happens, it starts dumping these huge amounts of snow on us. And boy, this late in the season, we're 25 degrees lower than our average, which we should be in the 40s by now. So there's a lot of us that have spring fever really bad and are pretty tired from this long winter looking forward to spring. In fact, I found out my guest tonight, who was a referral, talk about the small world category. It is so small, and I had no idea until 5 minutes ago when I'm talking to her on the phone. Like I said, Meg was a referral. I'll tell you about her in just a moment. And I didn't know that not only is she in the same town, but we live within blocks of each other, no more than probably a mile from each other. We had to start the show, so I couldn't get quite down to the Nat's Eye, but I mean really close. So this is a guest that I'll get to meet and have coffee with, which really doesn't happen often. So I'm excited. I'm going to bring Meg on in just a minute, but for those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We Recovery program because it is in the we find the new me. We focus on the 4 A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And for that, it takes a good amount of warrior. Portion of the show is always a featured guest. And the back portion or whatever we have left is open mic. and some great indie music sure to inspire. And much of that music is performed by people who have had brain injury touch their life, if not them, someone in their family. So again, I'm your host, Kim Justice, and welcome to Recovery Now. Hope you guys have all been having a good week and are warm. I've been seeing on Facebook that from where our founder is up in the Spokane area, so Pacific, what is that, Northwest, all the way to where some friends are in the East, it looks like we're not alone here in the Midwest. These fronts keep swiping through, and there's a lot of people that know what I'm talking about and are feeling it just the same. But Meg Bussing, and if I didn't pronounce her last name right, I apologize, and she can correct me immediately when she comes on, knows that everything can change in an instant. After emerging from a coma with a traumatic brain injury that would lead to a decade-long battle with intractable epilepsy, she discovered that the world does not always understand invisible changes. However, nothing has stopped her from boldly pursuing her dreams. As founder and executive director of the Midwest You Can Foundation, Meg has created Camp You Can, a unique opportunity for kids and young adults with epilepsy to come together to see all they can do. The website you can check out, and I'll be mentioning this several times throughout the show, is MidwestYouCan.org. And you can get more information there. Meg also did a TED Talk, which is really cool. And I'm going to have her tell us a little bit about that tonight. So with that, I am going to bring on my newfound neighbor. Meg, you're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Hey there. I am chilly, too. It is freezing here in Nebraska, in Omaha, and I can't believe we're live so close together to know how cold it is outside. But thank you for having me tonight.
You're welcome. I kind of wondered, I was glad that snow ended this morning. You just don't know. So heavy and so much of it that I feel blessed we haven't lost our power at all during any of this, because it seems like, God, I don't know, what have we had, like one weekend the whole winter? It's good for the people that are working, but it snows all weekend. And then the other time, you probably wouldn't have any way of really knowing this unless you had a radio show on Wednesday nights, but we've gotten a lot of those tweener snows on Wednesday nights, and I keep thinking, God, I hope it doesn't land on the wires in the back, because I look at the tree branches bending down but nope, the power has stayed on. If you can just stay warm, hopefully, gosh, and next week didn't look like it was going to be any better. I'm waiting for us to get to our seasonal norm, which would be in the 40s, and geez, what do we have, like a week left in February, and then we'll be TBI Awareness Month coming up in March. But kind of crazy to be having winter go so long. But Meg,
yes,
welcome to the show. It
well,
is.
Well, thank you very
much
for having me.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about, I kind of like to start at the beginning and move forward.
That's
why don't
a good
you tell
way to
us?
Go.
Yeah, what the heck? It's real linear. That way I find that people like me with a brain injury, possibly people like you with a brain injury, you know, we have a tendency to lose our spot or wander, that sort of thing. And so I find if we kind of start at the beginning and take a linear approach to these interviews, that it makes it easier for both of us to keep track. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what was going on in your life, what you were doing, and then up to and including what happened that you incurred your TBI?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, I can remember the day. It was March 6, 1998, my freshman year of high school. I was at the top of my game, a successful basketball player, and I was on student council and just enjoying my time as a freshman in high school right in Lincoln, Nebraska. And on the way home from school, one day the driver swerved and crashed into a tree. I was in a car with four of my girlfriends just on the way home from school. And so, you know, that was kind of the beginning of the journey that I have been on.
Wow. So it was your car that you were in with the gals that hit the tree?
Nope, it was the older sister of a friend of mine. So she was just in the front seat driving, and I was behind her, and we were just on the way home from school. It was sunny outside, normal day, and she lost control of the car, and it hit a tree.
Oh, my God. So you hit your head then? You're in the back seat. How did everyone fare from the accident?
Yeah, everyone else was okay, thank goodness. The four other girls came out of it okay. And I always say, you know, I have the physical, you know, the physical aspects of the accident, where they have the mental and emotional, you know, they're the ones that remember what happened. Luckily, thank goodness, I don't remember that day. I don't remember what was going on, but those girls, you know, remember how it happened. And so I, you know, as I get older and older, I just think, wow, that would be, you know, something hard to deal with, seeing your friend in that sort of shape after a TBI.
Yes, that's very interesting, though, when you, as I hear you say it, that a blessing that you don't remember, but a horror.
Yeah.
that's something they must, you know, that's one of those memories you can't unsee that stays with you for ever. So I guess everybody in that accident has their struggle. So you hit your head then in that accident? What was the nature of your TBI when you say your friend saw you like that? What happened to you in that accident?
Yeah, as the car spun around, my head went through the passenger window and hit the tree. On the left side of my brain. So, yeah, thank goodness I don't remember it. But, yeah, they say the car spun and my head went through the window and hit the tree. That's how I was knocked out with a severe traumatic brain injury.
I guess. Okay, so you were taken to the hospital. That's a very serious injury. Were you, you said you were knocked out, so were you in a coma then?
Yeah, they had to, my lungs had collapsed, and so I ended up on a ventilator, and I was in a coma for about 5 days. So completely out of it. So I always thank my poor parents, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, they got the call. They must have been horrified, surprised and horrified. You don't expect or ever want to get a call like that about one of your kids. Gosh. So when you, it sounds like you had not only the brain injury, but as you said, your lung collapse, I'm sure a lot of bumps, bruises, and everything else. But what kind of shape was your head in?
Yeah, they, you know, had a temporal skull fracture and then the back of my skull. And then my brain got so swollen that they had to put something, a tube, or I can't remember what it's called, to monitor the pressure in my brain since the pressure was building so much. And so, but I, stayed in a coma, my parents by my side, and, you know, I broke my clavicle, some ribs. But
gosh.
That was about the extent, you know, mainly was just that darn brain injury, and pressure was built up so much in my brain, so they really had to keep on top of that to be sure that the pressure was going down as I was in the coma.
Was that a shunt? Do you remember? Is that the right word? I'm guessing too.
No, I don't think it was a shunt, and I'm trying to think of the name, but I think it just monitored the pressure in my brain.
Right, I think the shunt does fluid or something.
Yeah, drains fluid, but I can't remember the name of where it just monitored the pressure to be sure it was going down instead of going up in pressure. So they did
and
a good job keeping an eye on me.
Yes, they did. So was the pressure going down as they were monitoring you?
Yes, thank goodness it was going down. And so that's, I think, how I eventually came out of the coma and woke up hearing, "Hi, Meg, you had a traumatic brain injury." So that, you know, I vaguely remember, but just freshman in high school, 14 years old, you know, just hearing that I had a traumatic brain injury, I had no idea what that meant. I just thought, oh, I woke up. My hair was a little messed up because they had to shave part of it to put that monitor in my brain.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I was so devastated that they shaved part of my head. As a 14-year-old, I'm like, what am I doing with part of my hair shaved off here? Because I had no idea what a traumatic brain injury was or what it meant for my future.
I'm surprised that they did, frankly, because mine was in 95. 98 is only a few years later, and I didn't, it sounds like they handled things competently, at least up to this point.
Oh, yeah, they were great. Yeah, yeah, they were great back then and continue to be awesome.
Do you go to the med center?
Back then, I was in Lincoln with the car accident. So it was actually the old, they called it Lincoln General Hospital. But I think now it's Bryan LBH. Yeah, so they rushed me to that one since it's more of a trauma hospital back in the day.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, hard for me to remember back that far. But so,
yeah,
they were right on top of it. And so when you woke up and they told you you had a traumatic brain injury and you didn't know what that was, and I didn't know what a ruptured aneurysm was either when I woke up.
Yeah.
And I had a similar experience to you because they shaved half my hair too. I was a little older, but it's
it's
horrifying no matter what, man.
It is.
I mean, having half your hair gone, for God's sake. Especially, and it's funny, you know, people listening out there might think that sounds odd in view of the horror of the accident that we just heard. you know, and those that know my story, that we would think of such a thing. But, you know, at that moment, you've got, you know, you've just been checked out, you know, for a number of days, and wake up and have no recollection, you know, of what happened to you, or, you know, you're just finding out you're in the hospital and you're probably pretty sore, but the first tangible thing, you know, you're going to notice if you're a girl, you know,
men,
I can't speak for them, you know, theirs grows back a lot faster, but, you know, for ladies, that's a heck of a, one of the first shocks that we go through. And when we find out that's the least of our worries, as we go down the road, the story's a little different. But yeah, right when you wake up and don't even know what happened, and they tell you and you don't even know what that means, you know, then the only thing they are aware of is what's obvious to you.
Right.
And that's very obvious, obvious to us. When you woke up, did the light bother you in the room, the bright light, or did they know to keep the lights dim, or did you, were you not really aware of that at all?
Yeah, you know, I don't recall having any sensitivity to light when I woke up, but, you know, 1998, that was a while ago. I'm sure my mom and dad would remember, but I don't recall being sensitive to light or noise or anything like that. I was just ready to get the heck out of the hospital. You know, that's the main thing I remember, is just wanting to get the heck out of there and get back to what I thought was, you know, normal life, get back into school, get back home. But those plans didn't turn out quite the way I had always hoped that they would.
Well, so tell us then, what did happen as a result? How did it go from there? So that's kind of the what happened. What was going to be the course of treatment for you?
Yeah, well, then luckily there's a great, you know, TBI rehabilitation right in Lincoln. And so I went there and lived as a patient for about a month and did the occupational therapy, speech therapy. And so PT, physical therapy, I mean, I passed out of that. I was pumped. I thought, nothing's wrong physically, which it really wasn't, you know, besides the brain injury, everything else is okay. So I remember playing basketball with the physical therapist and just, you know, that went really well. Occupational therapy, though, got a little bit more difficult because it was things like tying your shoes and buttoning your pants, and that seemed to be a little bit tougher than I had remembered it before. But then it was in speech therapy that I really realized something was going on.
And now your speech sounds perfectly fine, but back then, did you have a noticeable speech deficit?
Yeah, it was actually more like, you know, they would have a picture of a tree and point to it and have me name it, and I could not get the word out of my mouth. I knew what it was, but just couldn't get the word out. Or they'd show me some pictures, and then 5 minutes later show me the pictures again and ask me if I had seen them before, and I would say no, thinking I had never seen them before, but really they had just shown them to me. So that's when I figured that my short-term memory, it was more memory that I was having trouble with than actually speaking. Thank goodness that part of my brain, you know, but it was the temporal lobe was the one that was giving me trouble.
Well, what I was laughing at when you talk about memory is that I forgot it was speech therapy that did that, because I had that same problem. And there was like, do a list of I remember the pictures.
Definitely
remember the pictures. And I, you know, even now, a long time ago, I remember one picture that was like mom, dad, and a couple of kids, I think, sitting down to dinner in a dining room, a picture that was something like that. But they showed me, and that was the only one I could vaguely remember. I couldn't remember the other ones, but I remembered that one, but I couldn't tell you what color the walls were, what they were, you know, what they were eating, whether it was a boy and a girl. I guessed it seemed right.
Yes, exactly.
Mom, dad, a boy,
yeah,
and a girl.
That's exactly.
But I had no idea. Could have been two girls, could have been two boys. I didn't know what color hair they had, what they had on. I mean, just no detail at all. And that was the one that I could remember. All I remembered is a family in a dining room, you know, getting ready to eat. But I had no detail. Now, until you just said that, I forgot that was the speech therapist.
Yeah.
That we did that exercise in.
On it. Yeah. It's they do all these little tests, you know, with us to see how the recovery is going, but it's those little things that it's just, as it happens over and over, it gets so frustrating. Like, why can I not remember, just like you said, that the carpet is brown and the, you know, that the wallpaper is purple.
Yeah.
Like, they've told me that over and over, and then when they go back and ask me to repeat it, I cannot remember it. So it was just, yeah, those things that, you know, I started realizing when I was in speech therapy, oh, man, this thing that just happened might be sticking around for a while. You know, this potentially could be something I'm going to have to deal with for a while, you know, and it got really frustrating. Like, just why can't I remember? Why can't I name this? Why, you know, just so many why is this difficult for me. I decided I was going to go back to school and be that right back in there with my friends and playing basketball again. I had, you know, no idea the impact that a TBI could have.
Well, and that's the truth. So that's, I was going to say that's, what did they tell you? Because, you know, truly, they don't know how far a person's going to go. But one of the big things back around that time, and I hear it a lot, hopefully your experience was different, but that people, the doctors, will say that where you're at a year is as good as it's going to get. Did they give you any kind of an idea? Okay, so, but you said you were in rehab for about a month, so you're in the hospital and then rehab, and as you're going through these exercises and they're not going as well as they can, obviously at some time they're going to put you out of rehab, but you still have those issues to deal with. Now, did they give you any kind of, was there any kind of aftercare after you were there that month, or what did they leave you with as far as when you left rehab and you could walk and talk and probably look normal, more normal at that point, but your mind wasn't functioning correctly to your recollection? What was the parting prognosis to that? Do they tell you just work on some exercises and it might get a little better, or this is as good as it gets now after rehab? What did they tell you?
Yeah, they were awesome. And actually, I was discharged and sent home. So I was, you know, living at home, but I did outpatient speech therapy. So I would, you know, live at home and stuff, but my parents would take me back to the rehab hospital and I would meet with a speech pathologist. So that continued on all throughout the summer. So like the next 3 or 4 months or so, I would do outpatient speech therapy. So they really stayed on top of that, you know, because they said the more you work on it, you know, the better it is for your brain to either get back in there or for you to find ways to cope with or to get around the memory difficulty, you know. And that I really learned they had a point there. And, like, you'll figure out ways to remember or figure out ways to get around that. So maybe you'll keep a calendar with you, write everything down, make a to-do list. You know, they really practiced that with me, which thank goodness we had that available. And then going, luckily I did go back to school my sophomore year, and they set up some what they call accommodations for me in school. Mm-hmm. So they met with my high school teachers, and luckily I got like note takers in class. I got extra time on my tests, a separate testing area, and they all were really helpful, you know, to help me get back in there sophomore year of high school. So I think they did a really good job of helping me, you know, throughout the recovery and getting right back into school, which I'm forever fortunate for.
No kidding. That just sounds wonderful. I didn't even know back then, you know, I just started hearing about, now I was further down the road, but, you know, the assistive technology that they have now is incredible to help people.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even realize that they were, hip to even doing as much as they did for you back at that point. So that's fantastic that the school was familiar and willing and able to help with those accommodations so that you could get right back in. Now, even with that help and someone else taking notes, how did you do as far as remembering and processing the information? Did you find that to be difficult even with the accommodation, or did that, obviously that helped you a lot with the functions that were being taken care of, but how did that work for you?
Yeah, I think that really, really helped. I don't think that I could have, you know, gone through and finished high school if it wasn't for those accommodations, because I did notice that, man, it would take me longer and longer to just read a question on a test, to think about the answer that it might be, you know, just it was just moving a lot slower than it ever used to, you know, just the whole thought processing, I think, and just, you know, summarizing was a little bit harder. Writing just, you know, was just a little bit harder. But luckily, yeah, they set me up with those accommodations that really helped me pass. I even got extra time on the ACT test, you know, and so just learning to advocate for myself at a young age. It really helped me throughout college and even into adulthood, you know, learning how important it is to advocate and just, if you know that there's help, ask for it, you know. And so getting that going in high school has helped me ever since.
How are you doing emotionally with this? For example, were the friends that you were with, were they still around, and did you notice the chemistry of the friendships changing any from the external, and then just from the internal, how are you handling all of these changes? I understand the the being blessed and grateful for the help that we get, but there's still some feeling about being different than before. How were you doing with that, and was there any effect on first on you and then on friendships?
Yeah, there was definitely, it affected me because, you know, they were able to just jump right back into school. And I wasn't able to go back there with them. So, you know, being 14, they just got back into their normal life, and I was still at the rehab hospital, you know, and so it did get really frustrating, and I got really sad that I felt, you know, again, as a 14-year-old, felt left out, and, you know, that they were just able to kind of go on with life as normal, because I looked normal to them, you know. It probably wasn't as much of a big deal than if I, you know, had a cast or had crutches or, you know, stuff like that. They would notice me more. So it was tough emotionally, the recovery. And I'm finding that, you know, still today, that's kind of the last part of recovery for me that ever happens. It's more, you know, the physical, you know, you jump right back in there, the cognitive, you work on speech therapy and stuff, but then it's the emotional that sometimes gets left behind, and that, you know, was difficult back then, losing friendships because I was different or because they just went on with life. So it's really that emotional recovery that has taken a lot of practice, you know, throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think most of us go through that. It's hard to fathom, you know, and the two prongs to it. There's the how we feel about ourselves and how we process that, and then other people, you know, friends, family, whatever that might be, you know, processing that as well. And I think a lot of times, again, that's another downfall of the silent epidemic, is that when we
right.
look normal, walk and talk, and well, just that we look normal, that people can't fathom that it wasn't just that physical injury, the incident, we got fixed, and then we march merrily down the road back to normal,
right.
and that was in fact exactly what our expectation was too, but it didn't happen to work that way. So we learned coping skills and compensatory strategies. I make a joke. It was funny, you know, the first time I ever tuned into this, and I've been here every week for 7 years, the founder was doing a show and he was talking about, and I didn't know any survivors. I didn't have the same situation as you. I actually didn't go to rehab. That was neuro testing many years later when I did the test that you're talking about. But there was nothing right afterward. I had a visiting neurosurgeon, and my doctor had misdiagnosed me, so I never went back to him. And when they dismissed me, you know, the surgeon looked at me a couple of times and, you know, did some follow-up. And, you know, basically my head was still together. I don't know,
right.
But when he dismissed me, I was dismissed. And there wasn't any support groups. I didn't know any other brain injury survivors. So all those years later, like 17 years later, I turn on and I hear our founder doing a show, and he talks about being lost in a world of Post-it notes. And it was like,
totally.
Like I had got, Yeah, like I had gotten my hand caught in the cookie jar. Like, geez, what's this guy looking over my shoulder or something? Because I had them everywhere. And then, of course, I'd forget where I put the Post-it notes, you know,
yeah,
if they have to
totally.
Lose their gummy and go floating down on the floor, you know, I'd pick it up and throw it away. But, yeah, Craig, I'll never forget that. He was doing this talk, and it was like boom, 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 some of the things that he was saying. And that was the first I knew 17 years later that it was normal for somebody who had a brain injury or brain trauma of any kind to live like that. And, you know, for me, it was a secret between me and myself. I tried to talk about it a little bit in the beginning, but my new internist, and, you know, of course, the surgeon was gone. Nobody ever suggested that I go to therapy or that I have a neurologist or anything like that. And my new internist, you know, would want to throw pills at symptoms, but there really isn't a pill that can fix those things. In fact, you know, right. I found out years later after I did what he said, because I felt, I guess I needed to trust him because I didn't know anything. I hoped he knew more than me, even though my own doctor who misdiagnosed me and nearly killed me didn't know.
Gosh.
I hoped this new guy knew something. But, you know, the pills, a lot of the side effects of the first pills that they put us on, usually an antidepressant, figuring we're going to be depressed because of our new state of affairs, is, you know, one of the side effects is memory issues, you know,
right.
Ironically, suicidal ideation. I mean, you look at all the side effects of the antidepressant, which is usually the first thing they throw at us, and it plays right into brain injury, traumatic brain injury symptoms. And so that's a problem, because you do kind of want to know whether it's your brain injury or the medication. Like, would you be doing better in a certain category if you weren't on that antidepressant?
Right.
Especially if you still feel depressed. You know, which on here and with me, you know, I still, the pill didn't take that away, that I was still very aware in my skin every day and in my brain every day that I wasn't processing the same as I did before. I wasn't focusing as well as I did before. I had those short-term memory problems. You know,
yes.
Of course that's depressing, and the pill didn't make it any less so, you know.
Yeah, it didn't help with that aspect of it.
No, not at all. And so, you know, they're just, I guess just going back to the point is that, you know, for people that are listening who are maybe new survivors or caregivers or just interested parties, that, you know, what you see isn't what you get in a lot of cases, that there's a lot of things going on that you're not able to see. And, you know, it's terrible. I think some people are starting to get more aware, and that's what we're all, what you're doing, what I'm doing, you know, what a lot of parties are trying to do to raise awareness. But, you know, people would think that we were making these things up, or,
right.
I don't know, wimps, making it a bigger deal than what it really was, or malingering, you know, whatever the negative connotation would be, you know. And I always found that really hurtful. Later on, you know, after I got in the safety of, quote unquote, my people, you know, when I found a lot of other survivors who had been through the same thing, you know, at that point, I just thought, well, okay, they don't understand, but I'm not crazy, and it is real, because there's all these other people now validating and sharing their stories. That's one reason why I think this is so important. And, you know, you being here to, because as we hear these stories, you know, obviously there's some differences in every story, but there's also some similarities, and the fact that it's not just the head injury, but a big part of that head injury is not just the physical injury, it's the emotional aspect, as you said, of learning to deal with ourselves, coming to accept our new selves, and coping with the changes, and also the differences in relationships and people who maybe were really good friends who don't have the patience for how we've changed, or, you know, in any relationship, whether it's girlfriends or, you know, intimate relationships or whatever, any relationship, when one party changes, the other one is forced to change. And some are going to do that more gracefully and some aren't. You know, and
right.
And
exactly.
We tend to take that upon ourselves. At least I did. I won't speak for you, but in the early days, I took that upon myself and didn't consider it was their inability to cope with a new reality, their deficit, not mine.
Yeah,
it took a long time to come to that.
Yeah, it's just hard for people to understand because you can't see it, you know, and so therefore everything must be A-okay, you know, and with a TBI, that is definitely not always the case. And so I'm so glad that you have been able to find a group, you know, here of people who can relate, because it's like, if I meet someone, nice to meet you, and then if I hear that they have a TBI, it's like we automatically can relate to each other, you know? It's like you don't even have to do any more introducing yourself. You can, you know, right away understand where they are at. And, you know, it's just neat for an opportunity like this to meet other people with brain injuries is just a gift.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I just saw somebody come on the switchboard too that's been doing. Did you play basketball again, or was getting through school enough?
That was the bummer. You know, again, as a freshman in high school, I was so excited to just get back in the game. And I went into the doctor for my physical before basketball, and that's where he broke the news. And he just said, you know what, Meg, no more basketball ever. Because of the risk of another head injury, you just can't. And so I was, you know, devastated. No more basketball? What do you mean? I've played basketball since I was in second grade. What do you mean, no more basketball? But again, yeah, with the risk of another head injury, they just said, no way, Jose, can you play basketball anymore? So that was a big bummer.
Wow.
As a freshman in high school.
Yeah, I was going to say, at that age and with your love of the game, that had to be very hard. But now, you know, as an advocate, and I've pointed my gun toward youth sports. You don't usually hear it in basketball, but again, I am shocked that all these people you've worked with all the way through this story have been more forward thinking and on the ball than 98% of the stories I hear on here, Meg. You have no idea.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's good. Even though it was 1998, that's great that they were forward thinking, like you said. Yeah, thank goodness they didn't let me go back. You know, when back then I was like, how could you not let me go back? I'm going back, you know. But now as an adult looking back, thank goodness they didn't let me go back, because the doctor just said, if you have another head injury, that your percent, you know, that your recovery would be nothing like the recovery you're having right now. If I had another head injury, it'd be a lot. The outcome or the rehabilitation from it would be a lot harder, getting hit the second time. So, but yeah,
well,
thank goodness they were
they
ahead
knew.
Of the game. Yeah.
Yes, because even today, you know, they're letting kids back into the game after concussions, which are considered DBIs. You know, they're letting kids, well, obviously it's been going on in the NFL, but I look at youth sports, and for women, that the kind we had at school, but that high-ticket cheer group and soccer seem to be the first two highest incidents of head injury for women, and then football, boxing, obviously, out there for men. And, you know, repeatedly. Now, if they're adults, one of my aims in doing this is, you know, I wanted them to be aware just of what your doctors told you, because they weren't aware. I mean, the NFL knew 2 decades before and never chose to share with their players the risk that they were taking. And now you barely will hear of an NFL player who doesn't know of or know personally another player who has experienced some kind of terrible fallout, if not death, from repeated traumas to the head. And so I thought, once the word got out there, I left them alone, because I thought, well, you know, really, as adults, we, you know, we can all choose our level of risk-taking. You know, if we want to drive 100 miles an hour without a seatbelt, I guess we can do that. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
For the adult, but for kids, I really turned my sights from the adults to the kids. And there are so many. I've been, in fact, I've got a woman that will be on in a few weeks, and there was just an article, and I'll have to send it to you, Meg, because it's also someone here in the Midwest, but in Des Moines. You know, I'm hearing just about every week about a high school player somewhere around the country, football player, male, who dies from head injury. And so you take that down into the kids, you know, 7 to 14 in that Pop Warner age group. And, you know, they not only, you know, their brain isn't even developed yet. You know, they're still in the beginnings of their brain developing, and that won't be done until they're in their early 20s to 25. And so, you know, and you have some kind of an idea of what that would be like had those doctors not told, or the coach not told you what they did, of what would have happened at such a young age, particularly to have repeated trauma to the head, and how that could have ended your life or really made it so much harder to deal with for such a much longer time. And over now, you can see in retrospect, of course, back then it was the most important thing. Like you said, you had been doing it so long and it was your passion at the time. But now, you know, these years out, you can see that, you know, a small percentage are going to make it to the big leagues. And for the rest, it's something that, you know, a school activity that goes away and you move on with your life, and it would be horrible to lose the rest of your life over that game at such a young age. So again, I'm just amazed that they did the right thing by you, and so grateful they did the right thing by you by just coming out and telling you no, because that was in 98, folks. Today, they're letting kids get back in the game after a week or two all the time.
It's hard to watch, you know. It's just, if you want to say, if only you knew, you know, if only you knew that the lasting effects of a brain injury, if only you knew a repeated head injury, what that could mean, if only you knew that this sport is, you know, not as big of a deal as you think it is, that your child playing this sport is, you know,
and that's it a lot of the time, is that the parent did it when they were young, and they want to stretch that memory out and live vicariously through their kid doing it without any idea. You know, they had that risk, and you know, even if something didn't happen to them, or, you know, a lot of them may not be aware of it. There's a lot of, and we'll be talking about this more in March, but, you know, in Brain Injury Awareness Month, but there's a lot of, you know, we say 2.5 million people a year incur a brain injury, but that's just of the ones that know about it. You know, there's a lot of folks out there that may well have gotten a brain injury. Those parents who are sending their kids back in, maybe they're slower at processing or don't read as well or have some cognitive deficits that have just been part of them, and nobody even diagnosed them with a TBI. So they think that's just the way they came, you know? Which may not be the case. Well, let's go on with your story then. So you can't play basketball anymore, and that was crushing, but you were glad to be back in school and being able to finish high school. I'm assuming that was a huge deal. That would have been even more devastating to not be able to get through school in a timely fashion.
Yes, that was such a relief, too, to be able to graduate high school, and just, you know, such a big deal to have the car accident and then still be able to graduate with my class.
I'll bet your parents the day of graduation were just so happy. Tears probably came to their eyes when you walked across to graduate from high school, because it was so close that that might have never happened. You might have never had the opportunity to do that. When you were saying you were thinking, you know, about the friends and the parents, that's another thing. You're very unique. That's another thing that that I don't hear a lot on here, and it's not that brain injury survivors, I don't think, are innately selfish or self-centered, but we're focused, a lot of us are focused more on ourselves because, you know, we don't know if we're on foot or horseback, and nobody's given us a clue. There's no manual, you know, that says how you deal with this, and so we're maybe not thinking as much of what the others might be going through. We might be thinking of it in terms of how they're treating us and what impact that has on us, but not so much the impact that seeing us has on them. But that must have been just a thrill for your parents, particularly, and for you.
Yeah.
Phew. You got through and graduated from high school.
Yeah, such a relief and success, you know, to be able to go on into college.
Yes. So did you go right on to college?
Yeah, I after I graduated high school, I started college here in Nebraska, and luckily those accommodations that I had followed me right into college, so I was able to get the extra time on tests and separate testing area and stuff in college.
Wow, that's great. And what did you major in?
And I majored in, pre-nursing, and then took all the classes and made it into nursing school, too. So my mom is a nurse, and a bunch of my aunts are nurses, and so I had always, you know, wanted to be a nurse like them, and so it was a huge to be able to make it into nursing school after my, you know, the car accident and everything. Being able to make it into nursing school was pretty cool.
No kidding. I was going to ask, but you already answered that. You had the nursing legacy in your family, but then you also had experience with nurses in your own hospitalization and recovery. So you had a lot of exposure, and that is very cool. Excuse me, frog. That is very cool that you were able to get into nursing school. So really, in spite of the horror that happened to you and things that could have, hurdles that could have stopped you along the way, you kept going. You know, you met those hurdles head on, got the help that you needed, did your part, and were able to move on and do part of what you had planned. You weren't going to be a basketball star anymore, but you had wanted to be a nurse, and that's so cool that you were able to get in to nursing school. And so you got through that, because I noticed you are an RN, so you got through nursing school as well.
Yeah, I made it through nursing school, and there were some hurdles along the way with the, needing the accommodations that I did. I wasn't able to graduate with the class nursing school with. I had to kind of put a hold on my program so we could move slower through it. But just things like that. That, changed a little bit, but yeah, at least, I made it through, but it was in nursing school, that I started, having seizures from the traumatic brain injury.
That was my next question. I knew
that was
coming. I was waiting for when that came up. So now we're years out. So when would that have been? The accident happened in 98. There was no clue that this was going to come on, is my guess. And so how many years later was it you had your first seizure?
It was about 4 years later that I was standing up in front of my class, giving a speech or a presentation. And my heart started to race, just race. And it wasn't because I was very nervous, I didn't think. And then I was having trouble swallowing and couldn't catch the air or catch a breath. And then I noticed I started sort of staring off toward the left side of the classroom when I was giving my talk and just wasn't able to get my words out. But then that was only about, 20 seconds. And so I finished my presentation in nursing school in front of my class and went and sat down and just thought, oh, gosh, that must have been like a panic attack or something. But then it was after that class, my nursing instructor came up to me and said, you know what, from what I saw, I don't think that was anxiety. I think you might have had a seizure. She's the one who really helped me know that that was something that needed to be addressed right away, that it probably wasn't just anxiety. So that was my first seizure. So not all seizures are the same. Not all of them do fall to the floor and convulse. There are some, just different types. And my type is complex partial seizures. And that's just, kind of where you stare off into space and can't talk, trouble swallowing. Everybody's seizures are, the more and more I get to know people with seizures, it's just everybody's are so different. But they're still, a seizure. So that kind of, that first one kicked off the next 9 years of my life with uncontrolled seizures and the diagnosis of epilepsy.
Let me ask you a couple things, because I don't know a lot about seizures. When I, when you started talking about it before I got here, the only seizure I was ever aware of was, I guess, what would be the grand mal seizure, what a lot of people think of as epilepsy, and seizure is just one thing. Now, you actually made it through that presentation having this seizure?
Yeah, well, it started, and it was only about 15 seconds. So I stopped, but then, I was able to finish my presentation after the seizure stopped.
Wow, so there wouldn't have been a nurse there that... I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was going to say,
you're exactly right.
Amazing. It was a nursing class, and that a nurse came up and recognized it, or you might not have known is when you did.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, you're exactly right. Thank goodness. When I say how, dramatic it was, a seizure, they just like to come at the most inopportune time. Like you're saying, good thing it did happen in front of a nursing instructor so that, they could tell me, no, that's not anxiety. That seems like a seizure.
Wow. And that's called what again? What type of seizure?
That's a complex partial seizure. Bunch of different types, like we said. Grand mal, or now these days, it's called tonic. Clonic is kind of the other word they call the grand mal. But mine is a complex partial seizure. So, I was put on one medication, and, I had never really been on a daily medication before, so it was kind of tough to get used to at first. And I just noticed I was tired more often. But that's kind of they just gave me a medication, said, you have epilepsy, okay, bye. kind of like any other diagnosis that, you don't know much about it.
And here's where it starts to fall down a little bit.
Yeah, here's where it starts going
more normal. I thought it sounded too good to be true at this point. So does a seizure at all, regardless of the type, does that automatically make it epilepsy then?
they say if you have two or more seizures, then it's, you know, Kyle is epilepsy. So in between the time of my presentation in front of class, I had a couple more of those episodes. And since I had had more than two, they went ahead and just said, so you have epilepsy. And, you know, I had only heard about seizures on TV, and I didn't know anyone else who had epilepsy. And then just had no idea that that 10-second staring spell could cause such trauma.
Well, I was going to say, tell me about the others after, before you got that diagnosis. What were those circumstances, and were you able to recognize it? I mean, it sounds like the first time, obviously, you didn't know that it was a seizure, but you maybe were aware it was hard to swallow and had a little bit of awareness, but I suppose you were trying to focus on what you were saying since you were giving a presentation. After the nurse told you that you had had a seizure, the next time it happened, were you aware of it at all? Or how did you know about that one?
Yeah, you know, I just knew it felt the same. And I was like, oh, crap. You know, this feels like it did when I was in front of my class. She said it was a seizure. Could this be another one? And so it did feel a lot like anxiety, like with my heart racing and trouble catching my breath, trouble swallowing. So it did feel a lot like anxiety, but, you know, it was the same symptoms that happened again. And then it happened again a couple days later, and then I had my doctor appointment. So I was able to tell him, you know, it's happened about three times. And they said, well, if it's happened three times, then you have epilepsy.
Wow. So any variety of seizure over three times, and that's an automatic diagnosis. I didn't know that.
Yep, but over two times. I'm sure there are different, you know, maybe doctors would say that it depends on the type, or depend, you know, sometimes babies have febrile seizures where they have a high fever, and maybe that's why they have a couple seizures and then never have any again. So I'm sure it just is depending on the patient. But they told me that, you know, due to that leftover scar tissue on my brain that was still there from the traumatic brain injury, they said that's where you're having seizures. That's why they're coming, is there's scar tissue on your brain that's causing the abnormal firing. Going on in my brain, of the brain waves firing off. It was abnormal, so that's what was causing the seizures. So they said it's that darn scar tissue from your 1998 TBI. So here we are, and, you know, 4 years later, and now we're talking about the TBI again. I thought that was out of the way. I was doing, you know, as well as I could, made it into nursing school. I just thought, you know, this is what I had always dreamed it would be. And then, yeah. And then the seizures started, and, you know, it all went back to the brain injury. So it kind of came back.
I wonder,
you know,
what,
so.
I wonder what the incidence is. Not putting you on the spot, but I'll have to look it up if you don't know, but I was wondering what the incidence is of epilepsy after a brain injury, because most of us have scar tissue.
Right.
I wonder how many are walking around having that kind of seizure.
I don't know, or if the listeners, maybe if there are some that, you know, have epilepsy, because by now I've met, you know, other TBI survivors and stuff, and I have only met a few that have seizures too. So it must just vary based on the scarring, the injury location, you know, just TBIs are all so different and heal so differently. So, but that's just what they said, that mine was coming from that leftover scar tissue that was causing abnormal brain waves to be firing off on the left temporal lobe, is the fancy word, the left, right by my ear, that part of your brain, the temporal lobe. So that was a bummer. And, you know, really has led to where I am today, though, too. So I continued to have those seizures, and they kept adding, you know, here's another medication, here's another, here's another. So I was on 4 medications at their maximum dose, so it was about 20 pills a day. And their side effects alone were making school days, you know, more and more difficult. And then same into my nursing career, you know, making it hard to operate as practice as the nurse I had always wanted to be. Like my mom, right in there with patients, taking care of them. Because of my seizures, I kind of went from a direct patient care nurse to a phone nurse, where I was only just able to talk to patients on the phone because my seizures just weren't giving up, even after being on 4 medications, and they just continued to happen. And they were the complex partial, and continuing to happen for me means, you know, about 4 or 5 times a month. And some epilepsy patients, for them, often means every day, multiple times a day. You know, so it just varies. Gosh. But it's, yeah, such a life, just like a TBI, you know, epilepsy is such a life-altering diagnosis that someone can get, especially if they're uncontrolled seizures. I guess I should, yeah, say that. If they're, you know, having trouble controlling your seizures, it can be pretty life-altering.
Yes.
So that's kind of where I was when I went to the doctor and said, you know what else can we do? I don't want to go on another medication. Is there anything else? And he said, you know what, there's brain surgery that we're doing these days. We'll just go in, open up your skull, take out that scar tissue. Yeah, he said, we'll just take out that scar tissue from your TBI, take it out, put your skull back on, close you up, and hopefully you'll be seizure-free, is what he said. So right away I thought, well, peace out. I'm not going to do that. No way.
Oh,
am I going to get my head cut into? But my husband was there. Yeah, my husband was there, and he saw me every day, what I had to go through. You know, he saw firsthand, and he saw that the seizure medications alone were also, you know, making it hard for me. I was busy. I couldn't fall asleep, and that was more because of the medications I was on. So after I worked, you know, talked more with my husband and my family, and my awesome doctor, we decided to go ahead and pursue epilepsy surgery if it meant that I could have a chance at a better life.
Wow. So you did it?
So I did it. They did months and months of testing just to see if I was a candidate. So luckily they don't just go, okay, you say you want to get your part of your brain removed, let's go. They go through quite a bit of testing, you know, EEGs, MRIs, neuropsych testing, to see if you even qualify, to see if they remove that part of my brain, if I could still function without it. It's really neat what they can do these days. After all that testing, there's the WADA, the MEG scan, the EEG, the CT, you know, all of these abbreviations. They found out that I was a candidate for surgery. So after thinking about it more and just thinking about how much, you know, what else am I going to do? Am I going to go on a fifth medication and keep having seizures? You know, and am I able, at that point I had one child, and I thought, am I ever going to be able to have any more children if I keep having seizures and keep adding medications? So I went ahead and took my husband and my doctor's recommendation and, yeah, had surgery in 2011. And so they removed my left temporal lobe and hippocampus, which is underneath your left temporal lobe.
All of it?
Part of it. Yes, just the part
I was going to say.
The whole
scar tissue.
Yeah, just the part that was... the part that was causing the seizures, and then the whole hippocampus is what they removed.
Wow.
And so that surgery was and is the most terrifying thing I've ever done. But the seizures stopped completely.
Wow.
So thank goodness I had the, you know, pressuring from my husband and from my doctor. You know, they really wanted me to succeed and get through it. And so thank goodness I went through with surgery, because it's been a life changer for sure.
Wow. Well, and it's been long enough to know. I just, you're brave. Of course, I didn't go through what you've gone through. I started right out having the open brain surgery.
Yeah,
and I can't
you
imagine.
Had to have the surgery. Well, you had to have them right away, right on, you know, and you didn't have a ton of time to think about it like I did. And so that would be
right. I don't
very scary.
Yeah, I don't think I could do that. God,
well,
that's so scary. You're so brave. Well, I guess in a way, the fact that you didn't know what to expect was good. But how did you recover from the surgery? That brain surgery is rough.
Yeah, and but you know, kind of like a TBI, you know, there's not a lot of pain that goes along with, you know, just where they made the incision. There wasn't a lot of pain with it. And so it was just about a week-long hospital stay, and I was out of there. So it wasn't too, you know, it was stressful, and it was nerve-wracking and stuff, but physically everything went okay as far as pain and stuff like that goes. But then I was able to go home and do some, we didn't really have, you know, PT or OT or anything like that after epilepsy surgery. So it was kind of just going back home, getting lots of rest. And they told me to take it one day at a time, you know, don't go trying to make plans to, you know, get a master's in nursing. Don't go making plans to, you know, write a book or anything like that. Take it one day at a time after epilepsy surgery and just let my brain heal. They actually called it controlled trauma to my brain. So it was going to get, you know, it was controlled. I was in the OR. They were able to, you know, control pain and stuff, but it was still, you know, the brain getting picked at and, cut and stuff like that. So they did call it controlled trauma, which I thought was an interesting way to title it, but it's true. And so just
It is.
going home and resting, and then I thought I was going to get back into nursing was my next plan. But that didn't go, you know, as well as planned, just like, you know, life after a TBI doesn't always go as you plan. And, you know, because your left temporal lobe does control a lot of your short-term memory, recall, multitasking, holding a job as a nurse was already difficult, just because from the TBI, my memory wasn't very good. But especially after epilepsy surgery was when I noticed, okay, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get back in there. And I tried 3 different jobs in nursing. My favorite is pediatrics and community health. I just love working with kids, and at all 3 of those jobs, I was confronted by a supervisor. And they asked me in private if I had trouble remembering, and they said that patients and fellow employees were noticing, and just kind of nicely, you know, said, I just don't think this is a job you can handle, Meg. You can't, you know. So again, I heard can't. no basketball, and maybe even no more nursing, you know. And so that was, devastating to hear that.
Well, I was going to say, after, you know, the seizures were the reason, you know, you were put to the desk before, there had to have been high hopes at getting rid of the epilepsy, not for the sake of getting rid of the epilepsy, the day-to-day grind, the medications and all of that, but the hope of being able to do the things like nursing with the seizures being gone, that must have been that was a terrible disappointment. I'm sorry for that.
Yes, it was.
But
I'm sure a lot of people can understand, you know, and you understand, and that's what's so neat about this program and bringing us all together, because it's just really neat that
you
can understand
what
it's like.
Working with people and, you know, saving lives or damaging lives. In my case, I was managing people's money. You know, I was a financial consultant, and so I was lucky. I went back to work for a number of years, but I also was self-employed, and so I would say I had an appointment when I had a migraine or neuro fatigue or any of those lovely after effects that you carry with you. My juggling was living a double life. That was difficult. I did that a number of years. And then what did me in was when they changed the rules, you know, with the advent of managed care. For the longest time, health insurance, life insurance, investments, they had all stayed the same. You know, the rules were the same with some basic principles, and if you knew them, you were fine. And then Bernie Madoff came along and managed care came along, and all the rules changed. And, you know, I thought of that book, I'm Dancing as Fast as I Can. You know, I thought I would be able to adapt, but I couldn't. And that's something that still isn't understood, I think, by my family and other people that I know, that I just walked away at a point after I had gone back, because that probably made it even more confusing, the fact that I went back and that I wasn't honest, so people didn't know that I was living this double life that was really tapping me out. But when they changed the rules, man, on everything, and I couldn't, you know what it's like to read the, and I mean, Jesus, compliance. They cut down frickin' forests of small print, you know, to change all the rules. And you're sitting there trying to read this stuff and read the same sentence over and over and trying to then comprehend it. Focus on it and then try to comprehend it and then try to retain it, and there was just no way, just no way, you know. And I looked the same as I had all that time, and one day I just walked out and never looked back. And I didn't have any choice, you know. In a way, there was some relief. I was dying trying to keep up, you know. And so when the rules changed, that just put an end to it. But that also left me with not knowing, you know, what my purpose was, because I had only, unfortunately, like a lot of people in my era, grew up where you were, your level of success and your purpose was tied into your job, you know, and how successful you were. And that was all I had done for 27 years since I got out of school.
Yeah, that was you.
Yeah, I had no idea what the option would be. It wasn't going to be anything related, certainly. It wouldn't help me whether I was on the phone or in person. I couldn't remember all of this new stuff. So, you know, that was really difficult. But the other message of hope, you know, for me, and then we'll talk about yours just briefly, is that it was at that point, you know, I had journaled in that first year when I was recovering from my brain surgery. It wasn't a full year, it was like 10 months, but where I couldn't work or drive or that, and I journaled, and then I put away the notes because I wanted to forget it. Natural inclination, impossible to do, right? But I wanted to just forget it, put them in a drawer, put the whole experience in a drawer, and walk away from it. And did that for 17 years. And then in 2011, that must be when you were getting your surgery, that must be when I was leaving my career. And my mom had said every year since 95, you've got to write a book about your experience. You've got to write a book about your experience. And I would always, you know, say, oh, I'm much too busy. Someday when my desk is clear, I'll think about it. And I said that every year for like 17 years. And my husband wasn't around for my experience. I didn't meet him until a decade later. And I suppose we'd been married, well, let's see. We got married 05, 05, 05 at 5 on purpose so I'd remember it. So 5, 6, 6, 6, 7. Okay, so we were married 6 years when I left my career. And he, you know, I got depressed. I kind of really hit the hole for a while on that one, not knowing, you know, what the future was going to look like and going through the emotional stuff. And my husband said to me, well, and he looked into the, I had a real live office, but I also had an office at home and with the extra bedroom. And he motioned in one day and he said, well, you know, your desk in there looks pretty empty. And I said, well, of course it is. Why do you point that out? You know,
why are you pointing that out? Yeah,
I was usually had crap all over my desk. I'm not, piles. pile person. I know where everything in the pile is, but if you make me clean it all up, I can't find it. But that's how I was before my brain injury even. So there was usually, looked like a tornado went over my desk, but it was empty. You know, there it was just the laptop on there and nothing else. And he said, "Your desk looks empty." I'm like, "Why are you pointing that out?" He said, "Well, maybe it's time to write that book. I've heard your mom mention so often about your experience, and you've always said when your desk is empty." And
wow.
Well, I wasn't happy with that in the beginning, but it was kind of like
thing you said it.
Yeah, I was like throwing down the gauntlet, I guess. So, yeah, heck yeah, I'll sit down and write a book. And so I did that, and it came out at the beginning of 2012, and I didn't know internet radio existed then. I used to turn on my transistor radio and listen to Coast late at night because I had trouble sleeping. And all of a sudden, you know, the difference between 1995 and 2011 was the internet. You know, if I would have written that book a moment sooner, the internet wouldn't have been up and running and on everybody's desk. And I underestimated, didn't know, because I don't even think I had a social media account at that time. You know, I used email and the basics of the computer, but I started getting calls from traditional radio and then these hosts like me on this thing called internet radio. And I was telling my story all over the place, and that's when our founder, interestingly, he's in Spokane. He had a severe TBI from a car accident.
Oh,
he's
wow.
younger, so he knew about internet radio. And I think when he started Brain Injury Radio, I really shouldn't speak for him, but I think he was cathartically talking through, because he started pretty quick after his injury doing this. And I think he was processing what had happened to him on air. Well, in almost 2 years' time of doing that once a week, what he found out is that he was shocked like I was at the response of people, all these isolated, polarized people all over the world going through the same thing, who thought they were the only one, and oh my God, a life raft. And so while I was doing what I was doing, he was deciding that Brain Injury Radio was going to be 7 nights a week, and heard an interview and asked me if I wanted to be one of the original hosts. And so I've been here every week for almost 7 years since. And,
that's a wonderful story. Just the way it happened, you know, and how you came upon it and how your lives connected, really turning two not so good events into something pretty awesome that we have available for the TBI community, for sure.
Well, and then I'm going to turn it over to you for the rest. We've got about 20 minutes left, but that, you know, had you told me in the years before that, from where I was at, as you can understand, you know, that I was going to be an author and a radio host.
I
had no experience doing either.
Yeah.
Right. I would have laughed in your face. It's like, the only thing I know how to do is be a financial consultant. What do you mean writing a book and being a radio host, right?
Right.
And so there's no way, you know, that would have happened yet. That gave me my purpose, you know, my sense of purpose back. And it's been so gratifying to meet people like you and the listeners and the guests that are on the show. I've just met some incredible people and inspiring stories. And I wish I would have known, you know, I wish there would have been or I would have known something like this back. It sure would have helped me in my recovery. So that's, what I'm really devoted to these days is bringing stories like this, messages of hope, so that, you know, people realize that no, life isn't going to be probably the way that we planned it or what we wanted or the blueprint that we expected. But because those doors have closed doesn't mean all the doors have closed. It just means it's time to open up a new one. And if you're open to it, they'll present. You know, those doors will present. And for example, one of the things I wanted to ask you is about your TED Talk. Tell us about that. How did you, well, going back for a moment, you found out you weren't going to be able to be a nurse like you probably had really hoped since the seizures were gone, and that still wasn't going to do it. So I imagine you went through your dark spell also wondering what you were going to be doing. What happened from there?
Yes, that's exactly how I was feeling. You know, I would continue to apply for jobs and either not get them or, you know, realize why did I even apply to this because I know I can't do it. And so, yeah, it's like a grief process. You know, I felt like I was going through a grief process of what I had always thought my life would be to what I was realizing that it is going to be, the road less traveled, you know, and that it wasn't going to be the way I thought it was. But then I just knew at a point I needed to decide how I was going to react. And luckily with the support that I have, I had, you know, volunteered at a camp for kids with cancer in California in college, and just saw the value of bringing a group of kids together who really understood each other's cancer diagnosis and what it was like, and then just seeing them go on the zip line and the rock wall and just how beneficial it was for them and emotionally how much it helped them. And so it inspired me to create a camp similar to that here in Nebraska for kids with epilepsy. So I sort of took my nursing career and turned it into starting Camp You Can for kids with epilepsy is what I do currently with my nursing degree.
Wow, that's awesome. And is that once a year, twice a year? How does that work? How do people, well, and I'll go back and give your website and all that, but how does that work? Like, this wouldn't be a very good time to be camping.
These days in Nebraska, no. So I just want to say, you know, so many times throughout our life, we're reminded of what we can't do. And in my life, it was no more basketball, no more driving when I was having seizures, no longer able to be a nurse, and that meant no independence and no self-esteem. And I just realized kids and teens with epilepsy feel that way too, and they know that their disorder isn't just physical, having seizures, and that the effects are, you know, really mental and emotional as well. And so I wanted to create a place where they could come together and see all that they can do despite being reminded of what they can't do. So at Camp You Can, you know, just like the cancer camp, kids can zoom across the zip line, climb a rock wall, shoot a bow and arrow. But what's really cool and what I want kids to get out of camp is that, you know, quietly walking by the cabins and standing in the lunch line at camp, you'll hear the kids saying things like, you know what, my seizures are hard to deal with too. Or this is the only place I have to talk about seizures without feeling embarrassed too. So it's so cool. You know, I'm all about the emotional effects that camp has on the kids, you know, and the feeling of seeing what they can do despite their epilepsy. And so yes. Now we've been having Camp You Can. This will be the seventh year, and it's a three-night, four-day in June is when we usually do it. Parents drop their kids off and get to have some alone time being parents and, you know, focus some attention on their siblings and just dropping their kids off at a safe camp. You know, we have registered nurses, and we even have an epileptologist, which is a fancy word for like a neurologist specializing in epilepsy, that comes to camp. So I always say safety is our number one priority, closely followed by fun. But this has just been healing for me to start this camp, you know, and really find that, hey, I can't be the nurse I always thought I would be, but look, this is something I can do, and then this is also a place where kids can come and see all that they can do as well. So now Camp You Can has turned into the Midwest You Can Foundation, a 501c3. So we can work not only with kids, but adults like myself with epilepsy. And we just, to combat our challenges through empowering each other, celebrating all the amazing things that we as adults with epilepsy can do as well.
Wow, so that is really awesome. How did you know how to do that? Because you went to the cancer one and you modeled it similarly?
Yeah, I sort of took, you know, I was a camp counselor in California, so I saw, you know, kind of the ins and outs of being a camp counselor, but the extra work has come as being what an executive director does, you know, and all the behind-the-scenes stuff that I didn't know when I just thought, you know, you come to camp, you sing songs with the kids, you play games with the kids, you just help them have the time of their lives. But then now on the executive director side, I'm learning more of the fundraising aspect and, you know, just getting the community involved and working towards our mission. So it's been a good turnaround from, you know, feeling very lost and hopeless to finding something that I can, you know, that I can do. Despite my TBI and epilepsy.
Absolutely. They have a camp we should maybe consider going sometime. Don't think I can do it
this year.
Yeah,
you're
right
here.
Like
you're right here in Nebraska. Yeah, you can just pop on
no,
by
but the
you're right here in Nebraska.
That we can do, but the TBI camp, and I think it's in its about 13th year, is up in on a mountain in Washington State where there's no
awesome.
Beautiful lake, beautiful mountain, no reception.
yeah.
And the camp has been a huge success. I've not been to it before. I'm not a huge camper, and I'd be more comfortable probably close to home. I never was a huge camper, and I'm not a huge camper now, but every report I've gotten has been that they have a blast. And so I see that he just came out with the t-shirt, and I'm going to have to look up, the camp is in June also. I'll have to look up the date and just tell you when it is. It's called the Skookum, Washington, I believe. It must not be, you must fly into Spokane, that's where he lives, and then the mountain maybe it's a national park or something, this Lake Skookum, because they drive up a mountain. And there's a lake up there, and so Craig would know something about what you go through being the one to arrange the camp and all of the things that you do at camp. But it's been really gratifying for everyone who makes it from across the country to go
yeah,
to the camp.
That's
and
amazing. Yeah.
I think it's like a week long, but again, and then just the last thing I wanted to get in is, so that gave you purpose and different skill sets to work with in creating this project. How did you then do a TED Talk? How'd you get involved in that?
Yeah, well, I had heard of TED Talks before, seen them, you know, here and there on the computer, but, you know, I have an amazing board of directors now with our 501c3 Midwest UCAM Foundation, and just always are encouraging me to get out there and speak and share my story. But I am not always comfortable sharing with a crowd that I have a TBI and am no longer a nurse and, you know, going into all of that. So I've left that kind of quiet. But they, you know, encouraged me to apply to do a TED Talk to just get the word out, you know, and get the word out about camp and more speaking opportunities for myself. So I thought, oh gosh, I'm not going to get a TED Talk. I'll try out. And, but I got it. So then it was like, oh great, now. But I worked with an awesome coach, and they were really sensitive with my memory, you know, and just kept encouraging me, the people, the TED community, just really encouraged me to, you know, get up there and speak your mind and just share your story. And so in October, did my TED Talk, or it's TEDx Talk, and it's called Yes, You Can. And I just shared sort of the story I'm sharing here. And it was very, you know, therapeutic, too, to get it out there and let people know that, you know, it's okay to talk about brain injury and epilepsy and things that they're going through, and just what we're shooting for at Camp You Can is just for kids in the community to come together and, you know, see all that they still can do. So yeah, the TED Talk has been a huge gift, you know, after thinking, no way am I going to get up there and share my story in front of hundreds of people, to then actually doing it is just like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I was able to share.
So you went there somewhere? You left and went somewhere and spoke?
It was here in Omaha.
Is that out where?
It was here in Omaha. Actually, here in Omaha, they have TEDx Omaha is what it's called. And so
really?
I spoke at it. Yeah, and I didn't know that they had it either. But it's right here in Omaha, and they have a TEDx Lincoln, and where people can just get up and share their stories. So it was a really neat experience with amazing. The other speakers were just amazing stories, and just the TED community is very encouraging and positive. So it was a really
That's
neat
so
experience.
Cool.
Yeah, I would never
yeah.
have known if it wasn't my board of directors that encouraged me to try out. You know, I just thought, nope, I can't. And they're like, girlfriend, you're telling everybody else, yes, you can, so you better try
yes.
out to see if you can. And they were, you know, they were right. So it's now I'm more comfortable sharing my story. And I think that's what TED has done for me, just really open. I've been able to open up more about my difficulties that I've had with my TBI and epilepsy.
Sure. That is just awesome. I had no idea that we had such a thing. I've got a co-host on the fourth Wednesday of every month, and Simon is in L.A., and he did one of these talks, a TEDx talk, and of course, I have heard of TED Talks before and all of that, but not anybody locally, and I certainly didn't know we had anything like that here. I mean, he's in L.A., so I thought that, you know, you had to be somewhere fancy.
Yeah, see, come that's what I always thought, too.
We're fancier than I thought here in the Big O.
Yeah, we are. We are fancy like that. So,
well, congratulations. That's just wonderful. And everybody, make sure to check out MidwestUCan.org. Again, MidwestUCan.org. That is in the program notes of the show. So any place that you might have clicked the link to hear the show tonight, or if you're listening on demand sometime after this live program, it's right there in the program notes, the website to MidwestUCan.org, and the Yes You Can TEDx talk by Meg Bussing. Am I saying your last name right?
It, you know, it's Boozing, but it looks
Boozing.
Like Boozing. So, yep. So
okay.
Either way it works. But, yes, it's Boozing.
Boozing. I want to get her right. Okay, so TED Talk, TEDx Talk, Yes You Can, Meg Boozing. And that's B-U-S-I-N-G. And so be sure to check out both of those things. And Meg, thank you so much for coming on tonight. We're down to our last 2 minutes, but I appreciate hearing your story and the way that the challenges you've been through, the way that you've turned them around and what you're doing. I find that a lot of us wind up doing service back, paying it forward, and nothing we ever expected to do, but working in the community that, you know, we started the struggle alone and wind up incorporating into this community, getting larger and larger, where we can help raise awareness and help others not go through a lot of the things we did and carry these messages of hope that life might not be like you expected, but it can be amazing beyond your imagination. You just have to stick around until the miracles happen and keep your mind open and listen to those people, like my husband, who told me to write a book, and Meg's board of directors,
exactly,
who said yes you can. You know, there will be people in your life, for all the ones that cried foul that aren't there anymore, there will be those people that will open up the door to opportunities and walk through it. There's no penalty for getting off the bench and trying, except building a life worth living. So thank you so much, Meg. I look forward to talking to you again really soon and meeting you in person.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate it. And just for having these discussions, it's just so, you know, the few that I've listened to, I mean, they're just all very therapeutic, you know. It's just awesome to hear people sharing their stories. So I appreciate this opportunity.
Truly is. Okay, thanks so much. So thank you for listening tonight, everybody. I'll be back next week. Should be a Simon Says episode. Good night. God bless. And here's a little something it takes for us to come through this process. This is Hannah Kerr, and the song is Warrior. You can find her at hannahkerrmusic.com. Good night and God bless, everybody. Thanks so much. Thanks, Meg. Thanks, listeners.
Thank you.
down the face of fear. Gotta keep breathing.